This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning in to the Planet Microcap Podcast. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's BobbyKKraft, and you are listening to episode 27. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I spoke with Chris Mayer from Bonner & Partners. Chris is also the author of the book 100 Baggers, Stocks That Return 100 to 1 and How to Find Them. We interviewed Chris in Vancouver about 1 year ago, where we began this discussion of 100 Baggers, and I wanted to flesh out this concept a little bit more. The goal for this interview is to define the concept of 100 Baggers and what that means, and is investing in a 100 Bagger every investor's dream? Thank you again for tuning in to episode 27 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with Chris Mayer, but first, a word from our sponsor.
A comprehensive streaming of market data, research, and portfolio management application for you. QuoteStream is a real-time streaming quotes and research system designed for the day trader, retail investor, institutional investor, both new and old. QuoteStream offers low latency, tick-by-tick data, advanced charting, comprehensive technical analysis, news, and research. With no software to install and no servers to maintain, QuoteStream is the ideal solution for you. Go to stocknewsnow.com and start your free 7-day trial. Click the QuoteStream banner in the header or real-time quotes in the nav bar to get started building and managing your investments.
For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I have Chris Mayer from Bonner & Partners on the program. Chris, welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Robert.
No, it's great to have you. And as we normally do start off with each podcast, let's start with your background.
Sure. Well, I started in corporate banking back in 94 at a college, studied finance in college. And corporate banking, I was on the lending side, which is a really a good spot to learn as an investor, because as a banker, you're always thinking about downside protection and margin of safety, and you get to learn about a lot of different businesses. So there are a number of investors who started out with a credit orientation. I always think of Marty Whitman at Third Avenue had a big impact on how I invest. And I did that for about 10 years, but I always had a passion for investing and writing, and so I would write and freelance on the side. And then finally in 2004, I started my own newsletter. It was called Capital in Crisis. And within 6 months of starting it, it did well enough where I was I left the banking job and decided to do writing, write the newsletter full-time. And I did that for a long time until this year. In January, I joined a family office, and I write a new research service there called the Bonner Private Portfolio. So the Bonner family office has a publishing arm attached to it called Bonner & Partners. And so that's why right now it's mainly focused on sort of long-term investing. And last year I put out the book that you mentioned, 100 Baggers, which I guess we will talk about more here shortly.
You read my mind. so as you said, you are the author of the book, 100 Baggers. You know, that's kind of the main theme of today's podcast, you know, because as we'll find out shortly, you know, when it comes to what that means and a little bit about the book. But let's start first with a general overview of the book, and then specifically, what is a 100 bagger?
Yeah. Well, it started with, there was a speech that Chuck Akre gave. I don't know if you know Akre, A-K-R-E, Akre Capital Management. He's a very good investor and has been for a long time. And he made a speech in 2011. It's called The Investor's Odyssey, or An Investor's Odyssey. If you Google it, I would recommend. It's a good speech. He talks about the power of compounding. And in that speech, he mentioned a book by a guy named Thomas Phelps called 100-to-1 in the stock market. And so I read everything. I thought I had read everything I could read about investing in stocks, and I had never heard of that. So I went and got it, and I really liked the book. So he talks about stocks that return 100-to-1. That's what a 100-bagger is, a stock that returns 100 for every dollar invested. So $10,000 would turn into $1 million. And in his book, he did a study of the stocks that had returned 100-to-1 from like 1932 to 1972. The book was published in 1972. And I really like that book. He's a good writer. He has a sort of folksy style, and there are a lot of really good lessons in there for investors. And so I would quote the book and write about it. And then one day I had a reader who said, you know, you should update it. And I hadn't thought of that. I said, well, that's a really good idea. So that's where the inspiration for 100 Baggers came from. I decided to update Phelps' study. And so I looked at stocks that returned 100-to-1 from 1962 through 2014. And with the idea that I would try to tease out what sort of similarities there might be between these. So that's how it got started.
Okay, what was like the main thesis? You know, like what was your greatest discovery when you in doing all that research?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of different things I learned about the stocks that had those kinds of epic returns. I would say that the most important thing, and I should say when I did this study, I looked at stocks that I cut off some of the tiniest stocks. So I was trying to look for stocks where there might be some sort of predictable element. So there are things like, 25-cent junior mining stocks, whatever, that might have gone up 100-fold that didn't make it into the study, or some, you know, tiny biotech company. I drew the market cap line at about $50 million in present-day dollars. So just to screen out some of those tiniest names. And so the median company in the study had about $170 million in sales when it began its run to 100 baggers. So we're talking about businesses that are a pretty substantial size. But I would say the most important thing then that came out of the study for me was this idea of return on invested capital, return on equity, however you want to think about it, and the ability to reinvest again and again, so and earn those same high returns. So if you have a business that you put $100 in and it returns $20 after that first year, we would say, okay, that's a 20% return on equity. And then if you could take that $20, that entire $20, and reinvest it again the next year and earn 20% on that again, and then take the profits and earn 20% again, and you keep doing that year after year after year, that's where the real sort of flywheel starts to kick in. And so then it just becomes a matter of math. If you compound your capital at a 20% rate for about 25 years, you're going to get to 100 baggerdom. And then it becomes kind of this graded scale. The more, higher your return is, the faster you become 100 bagger. And I really think that's important because many investors won't necessarily pay attention to the reinvestment part. And that really is a great, great business, one where you can earn that high return on capital and you can reinvest all those profits and do it again and again and again. That, to me, was really the most important lesson to come out of it. But there are a lot of other tangential lessons that are important as well, such as, and I sort of mentioned one already, which is they take time. And so you have to, hold on to these stocks and figure out ways to fight past the volatility. And there's a number of other things sort of like that.
Right. And we'll definitely get into those for sure. And so then what is an example of a 100 bagger? I mean, do you want to maybe go through one that was in the book?
Yeah, I mean, there was 365 100 baggers that I identified in the study, and these are, again, stocks that returned at least 100-to-1. And, I done a double count a bunch of them. Some of them, returned went up thousands of folds. So the top-performing stock was Berkshire Hathaway, which even gets its own chapter in the book, and that's a stock that we own now in the family office. And there have been other stops up there: TGX, Monster Beverage, Walmart. There's a whole bunch of them. But I can talk a little bit about Berkshire Hathaway. I mean, that's such a well-known name, but it was the top performing stock as well. And even in that case, there were some interesting things that you could take from Berkshire Hathaway that might be surprising. So, you know, Berkshire Hathaway's compounded at roughly a 20% rate for 50 years. It's really been an incredible stock. But there have been fairly lengthy periods of times where it went sideways. I know there was one time in the 90s where it was something like 5 years you would have held it and gotten no return whatsoever. And so when you think about how difficult that would be, you know, think about what a mistake it would have been to sell a stock like that just because it hadn't gone anywhere for a few years. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges with these 100-baggers is sometimes you're going to go through stretches where nothing happens. And that can happen even with the very best stocks went through periods where nothing happened, and the very best stocks went through periods where they got crushed. In the book, I mentioned Netflix, and that's one that I don't own and have never owned, but it's still interesting to think about. Netflix, I'm not sure it's a 100-bagger. It wasn't one of the stocks in the study, but nonetheless, it's been up 60, 70, maybe it is. I know it was up 60 times when I wrote the book. It's maybe up more now. But that's a stock that has suffered some tremendous, you know, drawdowns along the way. There's been a number of times where it dropped 40%, and that can be very difficult, as you know, for an investor to hold on during that time. But if you had sold out, you know, you gave up just tremendous, tremendous gains.
Basically, what you're saying and the real essence is, you know, I guess I'm, in my opinion, really, I would think that, you know, being able to pick a 100-bagger is every investor's dream, right?
Yeah, I mean, because it's just, you know, I would love to just find a stock you could park $10,000 in and have $1 million later, and that's just tremendous. You don't need to find very many of those to make a life-changing impact on your investments. But, you know, sometimes people will take the 100-bagger quest thing a little too literally, and they'll say things like, well, you know, your odds of finding 100-bagger, you know, are really low, or hey, how do you think you're going to be able to find these stocks? And it's not necessarily that you're going to find a stock that goes up 100-fold, but the idea is that these were the stocks that did it, and you can sort of study them and see how they did it and what ingredients and elements contributed to that, and then you can look for stocks that are similar or have the same sort of pattern. You know, investing is a lot of times just about pattern recognition. You identify certain things that lead to success or that are predictive of success. And so I often, you know, tell people, well, I don't think, you know, if I find a stock that triples, people are going to be very happy. Or if you find a stock that goes up tenfold, you're going to be pretty happy. So I wouldn't, you know, get too literal about the 100-bagger, but we are looking and at the stocks that really the best performers of the last 50 years is what this book is all about. Mm-hmm.
So how does the term 100-bagger relate to microcap stocks?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, most of them were microcaps when they started. So in the study, again, I had 360-some stocks, and the median sales for that group was about $170 million. So they're small businesses, but they're still real businesses. I mean, one of the things I think the book dispels is that I think a lot of people had this idea that for a stock to go up that much, you have to start with penny stocks or something like that. And you have to, you know, buy some stock that has no revenues, no sales, but it's going to find some new drug or whatever. And I think what this, one of the things this study shows is that you can get there with just solid businesses, really good businesses that compound again over time. And most of them started out very small as microcaps. And so that would be a rich place to look because naturally, I mean, you're not going to make a 100-bagger buying Apple today or Walmart or ExxonMobil or any of those names. You want to find some of these names that are small, regional, that have the ability to someday be a national business or even a global business, and that's what microcap land is
So then, so all right, here's the $10,000 investment that hopefully becomes a million. According to your book, you know, what are the attributes of a 100 bagger?
Uh-huh. Well, in the book, I kind of summarized 10 different things at the end, but I would say, you know, again, I would emphasize the most important thing, which is, again, that ability to earn a high return on your equity, high return on your capital, and the ability to reinvest it again and again and again. That's really important. You got to have that engine in place, and when you have that in place, then it's just a matter of time. So the real question sort of becomes, well, what are the parts of that engine? What are some of the other things to look for? One of the things would be, you know, you hear the term economic moat or moat. You want to have a business that has a moat, that has the ability to defend what it's doing. And that can be through a brand or a patent or something like that. But for a business to become a 100 bagger, you know, you're going to have to compound at a high rate for a long time, and you're going to have to suffer through attempts of people to compete with you. So you think of something like Coca-Cola or McDonald's. These are businesses that have, you know, had very powerful brands for a long time that helped keep competitors at bay. People wanted Coca-Cola. They didn't want, you know, the alternative. So they wanted to go to McDonald's, and it was harder to compete with exactly what McDonald's provided. So you got to have a moat. You got to have some way to protect it. You know, in the study, it also, people are sometimes tempted to say that, price becomes not so important. In other words, if you're going to buy a stock that goes up 100-fold, then, you know, you can buy it almost any time, and that's sort of true. A lot of these stocks in the study, you had years and years you could have bought it. You could just, you know, you didn't have to worry about where it was and the 52-week range. But when you really look at it, valuation does matter. So you would want to prefer lower multiples if you can, because that can really help you boost your earnings going forward. If you start with something at a low price earnings ratio and eventually grows into a much higher price earnings ratio, then that multiple expansion can do a lot of the work for you. So there's a number of examples about that in the book. I mean, the one that always stands out in my mind is the MTY Foods example, just because it's so extreme. And this was something that I got from Chip Maloney, who wrote about this on the MicroCap Club's website. And he talked about the stock that, you know, it became a 100 bagger over whatever it was, 10 years, let's say, and the earnings per share grew by a factor of 12. But, you know, how did it become a 100 bagger if earnings only went up 12-fold? Well, the answer is the price earnings ratio at the beginning was like 3.5, and it was something like 26 at the end of that run. So you had multiple expansion, which really helped propel that stock forward. You see it in a lot of other examples, even, you know, less exotic examples. I remember talking about Aflac in the book, which I think it was in 82, was a business that generated around $500 million in sales, and 20 years later it did $10 billion in sales, and the stock was a 100 bagger. And so you figure, again, how does it become a 100 bagger? You know, 100-fold return going from $500 million in sales to $10 billion, which is a lot, but it's not 100x. And one of the reasons is that it's the way the market valued and perceived Aflac. Before it had a low valuation, it was only valued at something like 1.5 times sales or something like that. And at the end of its run, it was like 6 times sales. So you had this, I call it in the book, the twin engines, because you have a lot of growth, but not just growth. You had a lot of growth and you had that multiple expansion. So you started with a low multiple, got a high multiple, and you really were able to propel yourself to a very big return. So that's important. Small, lower multiples. We talked about return on equity, the moat. You know, one of the other interesting things that came out of the study, and I write about this all the time, so readers who know me will know this is a theme I talk about a lot, but it helps to have an owner-operator. So a lot of these great businesses, not all of them, but many of them had a face. They had an entrepreneur, someone who drove it. So you'll think about Walmart, you had Sam Walton. Think about Apple, you had Steve Jobs. You know, you have Ralph Lauren. Well, you got Ralph Lauren. And so these were people who they owned a lot of stock and they controlled it. pushed it because they were talented, visionary people and made those businesses great. So obviously it can be very hard to identify who those people are, but it does seem to help if you have an owner-operator at the helm. And there's lots of studies that show how owner-operators will generally outperform their agents or their hired gun peers anyway over a period of time. So those were some of the important characteristics and things to look for. I think I've hit on most of the important ones. Mm-hmm.
So then when you're doing your due diligence and you're looking for potentially the next 100 bagger, you know, what's kind of the first thing you look for that may lead to greater investigation of that stock?
Yeah, well, I would say I always start with the proxy. Mm-hmm. And the reason is the proxy will tell you who owns what. Tells you how much management owns. It tells you their incentives, how they're paid. And it will also tell you the other people involved, so you can read about who's on the board and all that sort of stuff. And that's very important. One of the things I've learned over 20-plus years of doing this is that investing is really a people business. And if you don't trust the people involved, I wouldn't be involved in the business. If they're not incented correctly, and you see this a lot, I mean, that's actually hard to have a good incentive plan, but some are more egregious than others. If you see someone getting paid outrageous amounts of money and they're doing things that aren't particularly shareholder friendly, you know, that's probably not going to be your 100 bagger. So the proxy is important, getting a feel for the people and the incentives. That's how I always start. And if I like what I see there, I don't see anything horrible, then I'll go on to the next step, which for me, again, the old banker in me, but I do look first at the balance sheet and see how well this thing is funded. And that's another element that came out in the study. I mean, many of these companies, not all, but many of them were very well financed. They were profitable. They did not have to rely on going back into the capital markets to raise money all the time. And I think it can be difficult to be a 100 bagger if you're constantly having to go back to the market and raise money. Again, these are general rules. There's always exceptions. So I like the balance sheet also because, you know, it's like Peter Lynch once said. He said, I learned something very early, and this may be a revelation to most people, but it's very hard to go bankrupt when you have no debt. I think that's true, of course. So you sort of lower your risk level when you stick with companies that have a strong balance sheet. And that's a personal preference of mine. I don't really like to take balance sheet risk. And then the third thing, once I've got decent, I'm happy with the people and I think it's well financed, then I really go into study the business itself. And whether or not it's the kind of business that can sustain itself over a long period of time. And there's lots of businesses out there. There's lots of businesses out there that are not really good businesses, but they exist for years and years. There are some businesses that are decent. There are some businesses that are good some of the time, bad some of the time. When you're looking for 100 baggers, what you're really looking for is you're looking for really good businesses, businesses that can sustain themselves over years and years. Because, again, you're looking to hit that big number and compound. You need time on your side, and you can't have a business that doesn't have time on its side. And there are a lot of businesses like that, businesses that can be open to technological disruptions. And so you'd really, you know, you want to probably shy away from some of those. So those are some of the aspects of the due diligence. So I'm happy with the people involved and how well it's financed, and I like the business itself. Well, then I start getting into, like, well, what's the valuation like, and what would I pay to own this business? And I'm still very much into that value mindset. I don't want to, knowingly overpay for something going in. But it is important to say that, you can pay a fair price for a very good business, and that will work out probably better than if you bought, a decent or not even a very good business at a super cheap price. And that's the lesson that Buffett and Munger always talk about. Munger in particular, I know there's a quote I use in the book where he says that, if you buy a business, he says basically you should expect to get a return over the long haul somewhat similar to what the business itself earns on its equity. So if you have a business that, earns 12% a year, 15% a year,
So one thing we talk about a lot, or that we've talked about a lot so far, is time and this idea of having patience. And you know, as we all know, patience is a virtue. And it seems with 100 baggers, it's a lot of sitting and waiting. You know, so this seems much harder than it looks, right?
Yeah, in fact, I mean, that might be the number one. That might be the number one problem or the number one challenge. Is that ability to sit in your hands. And I know this from my own investing. As much as I write about this stuff and talk about it, I've still made mistakes also and sold stocks way too soon. It's just really, really hard when we are bombarded every day with messages and, you know, you see not only whatever, TV or Twitter or you're hearing ads, you're talking to your friends, and it can be really, really, really psychologically just difficult to sit on a stock that isn't going anywhere. And you see other people making money and stocks that are moving, and you have that urge to, you know, switch out of this deadbeat thing and go into something else that looks more interesting. And that's a killer. That's a killer, all that kind of switching to generating these kind of returns that I'm talking about in the book, because you have to sit. It takes time. Even the very best, you know, some of these, I do have about 50 or 60 names that managed to go up 100-fold in less than 15 years, which is a very fast pace. And we'd be happy and love to find something that goes up 100-fold in 10 years. But again, the challenge is sitting on your hands. Even when you have a very good business, it's difficult. I talk about Monster Beverage in the book, and that's one that became a 100-bagger in 15 years. And that stock had tremendous ups and downs. You know, that stock could fall 25% a month. I think there were 10 times where it fell at least 25%, and there were at least a few times where it fell at least 40%. And so if you're not, you know, it'd be easy to give up on it when you get bad news and the focus of the market and everybody's always on what's going to happen next quarter, and be easy to get rid of it and go to something else that seems better. So, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that's the big challenge. And I don't know. In the book, I offer some kind of tools that may help you hold on to these stocks longer. Yeah, it's a tough challenge.
Is meditation one of them? And going on,
you know, that might work. Why not? I didn't talk about meditation in the book, but you know, one tool I talk about in the book is this idea of what's called the coffee can portfolio, and I didn't originate that term, but the idea is that you buy a stock with the idea that you're going to sock away for 10 years and not touch it. And so if you partition out a portion of your portfolio where you think about it that way, it might be easier to do it that way. I think it's easier to do it that way. I have some money, for example, that I have in a separate account, so I don't look at it. I have a main brokerage account that I look at every day and focus on, but then there's another account separate that I don't look at every day, and I try not to look at it. In fact, I very rarely ever look at it. And those are the stocks and ideas that I've committed to just owning. I'm just going to own them. Own it like a piece of real estate. You know, if you were out buying a rental house, you wouldn't think to flip it and see what the price is every day. You own it as an asset, and you know the cash flows that come out, and you think about the appreciation over time. Anyway, yeah, I mean, that's, you have to find some way. If meditation works, do it. Whatever works, but you have to find a way to calm the itchy trigger finger.
That I got to tell you, that's been my biggest flaw right now. Is I'm committed to the ones I own in my portfolio, and yet it's so hard to not look at it every day. It's so hard.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and not even look at it every day, but it's also hard not to have you have your opinion change. So a lot of times, businesses of all types will go through periods of time where things are a little difficult, or they'll go through times where things look like they may not be great, and it's easy to sell them then. But you know, if you have a core thesis that really hasn't changed, and the business is still checking the boxes that we talked about earlier, you still have the same people involved, the same incentives, you still have the same you know, the business is still earning high returns on its capital. It's not threatened in that way. Maybe it's just going through a certain soft spot with sales, or maybe there's, you know, some little hiccup that invariably businesses go through. But if the main thesis is still there, yeah, I mean, most of the time, or I don't know, most of the time, but it does seem like most of the time, if you've done your work and you've checked all these other boxes, those businesses will come out of it just fine.
So how do you find the current environment? You know, are there always possibilities to find that 100-bagger?
Yeah, I would say there are always possibilities, only because when I look back over the study, I mean, in any year there were dozens that you could have picked. And Phelps did this. Phelps recognized this in his study as well, and he even has a comment in there where he says, where he talks about how he made a certain prediction. So this was a guy who, he had a varied career. He worked at a brokerage firm, Scudder Stephens & Clark. He wrote for the Wall Street Journal. He was an economist for DuPont at the time. And so he did a lot of different things, security analysis. And he has a story where he tells where he predicted successfully some correction that happened in the market. Whether he did it because he was skillful or lucky doesn't really matter. But he says that he would have been better off, instead of trying to, you know, spending all that time trying to guess at what the market was going to do, he would have been better off if he just focused on looking for 100-baggers, because they're all over the place. And yeah, it's interesting, because when people ask me about, you know, well, what's been your biggest mistake in investing, I often think about the mistakes of omission, the things that I didn't buy or didn't see. So I was, you know, invested in some stock, and maybe I did well or maybe I didn't. Maybe I made 50% of it over a couple of years or whatever and sold it. But if the opportunity cost of even something like that is really high, if you think you could have been in something that just compounds and compounds and compounds, you know, one of these kind of 100-bagger style stocks where you don't pay taxes because you're deferring all your capital gains and so on. So, yeah, I think there are always, even now, I'm sure they're out there. Just have to dig and keep looking and not worry so much about the environment. And if the market does, you know, collapse or fall, as it invariably goes through these periods where that happens, then you're going to have to be prepared to buy more of your favorites. Mm-hmm.
So then what is your advice for new microcap investors looking for that next 100-bagger?
That's a good question. I would say, what I like to tell people is the first thing to do, and the first thing to learn to do is to study businesses. And to learn to distinguish what's a good business and what isn't, or what's a good business, what's an okay business, what's a business that's not defendable. Really study businesses and learn the different models and types. And once you get the model in your head of what good businesses look like, that will take you quite a way. So it's not really about, you know, whether or not you look for certain financial indicators or chart patterns. I really think it's the heart of it is learning to be a good business analyst and to recognize when you come across a really good business. That's important. And then the second thing I would say beyond that, the most important advice I would give is learn to study people. Don't invest with people that you don't trust. You know, I was in banking for those 10 years, and there was an old banker adage that we would sometimes say, and it was attributed to J.P. Morgan, and he would say that he wouldn't lend money to a man he didn't trust for all the bonds in Christendom. So in other words, no matter how well collateralized he was multiple, many times over, he still wouldn't lend money to somebody he didn't trust, on the grounds that somebody like that would find a way to screw you somehow. So, you know, I think about that investing. It's just, you want to be with people that you think have a track record of success or that are otherwise seemingly trustworthy. And these are difficult things I'm talking about, studying businesses and studying people, but I really think that's really at the heart of being a good investor. If I can say I had two abilities, if I could wish for two abilities above all else, it would be to recognize what's a really good business and to recognize who are really, really good people. Because if you do those two things, the other stuff's easy. You know, the other stuff, kind of valuing a business, there's only so many ways to do it. Everybody uses the same kinds of tools, you know, and then it's a matter of buying those businesses and hanging on to them.
So where can our audience go and find more information about you and the Bonner Family Office?
You can go to the Bonner & Partners website. I think it's bonnerandpartners.com, and you'll see me there as one of the listed as one of the analysts. And I write the Bonner Private Portfolio. And, of course, you know, the book is out there and available everywhere. So it's on Amazon. There's probably bootleg PDF copy floating around. So I don't care. However you get it. I think it's. I think it'll help you, hopefully help your investing results.
And where can our audience go and find you on Twitter?
My Twitter handle is what is it? It's at Chris W. Mayer.
I believe so. Hold on, I'm checking.
Right. Yeah, at Chris W. Mayer. That's what it is.
At Chris W. Mayer. Okay. Chris, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast today. I learned a lot.
Well, thanks, Robert, for having me on. It's always fun to talk about this kind of stuff.
It was great, and I look forward to having you on again.
Okay, great.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay, thanks. Yep.
Thank you all for tuning in to the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, Chris, again for coming on to the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast. Go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap podcast. Stay tuned for the next Planet Microcap podcast, where we'll have our next guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of stocknewsnow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. Have a great week, everyone.